today by the Council of Elders. May I request that you show me to the official in charge of the waiting room?" He had come alone, as was expected of him. Another official came and escorted him to the waiting room, where he was advised to stay until there is word from within. It was a large room, more than 20 mats in size, known as the Orchid Room, after the paintings of birds and spring orchids on the walls and door panels. Before long, a servant came with tea and cakes, but that was Musashi's only contact with human beings for nearly half a day. The little birds in the pictures did not sing. The orchids gave off no fragrance. Musashi began to yawn. He assumed that the ruddy-faced, white-haired man who eventually appeared was one of the ministers. Perhaps in his prime he had been a distinguished warrior.
"You're Musashi, aren't you?"
Lord Sakai Tadakatsu said lightly as he sat down.
"Forgive us for making you wait so long."
Though lord of Kawagoe and a well-known daimyo, in the shogun's castle he was merely another official, attended by only one samurai. His manner suggested he cared little about pomp or protocol. Musashi bowed to the floor and remained in this position as he announced in stiffly formal language, "My name is Miyamoto Musashi. I am a ronin from Mimasaka, the son of Munisai, who is descended from the Shinmen family. I have come to the castle gate in compliance with the shogun's will, as stated in the summons sent to me." Tadakatsu nodded several times, causing his double chin to shake.
"Many thanks for your trouble," he said,
but then went on in an apologetic vein.
"With regard to your appointment to official position, for which you were recommended by the priest Takuan and Lord Hojo of Awa, there was, last evening, a sudden change in the shogun's plans. As a result, you will not be engaged. Since several of us were not satisfied with this decision, the Council of Elders reviewed this matter today. In fact, we have been discussing it until just now. We took the question to the shogun again. I am sorry to say that we were unable to alter this latest decision."
There was sympathy in his eyes, and he seemed for a moment to be searching for words of consolation.
"In our fleeting world," he went on, "this sort of thing happens all the time. You mustn't let yourself be annoyed by what people say about you. In matters having to do with official appointments, it is often difficult to tell whether one has been fortunate or unfortunate."
Musashi, still bowing, said,
"Yes, sir."
Tadakatsu's words were music to his ears. Gratitude swelled from the bottom of his heart, filling his whole body.
"I understand the decision, sir. I am grateful to you."
The words came out naturally. Musashi was not concerned with face, nor was he being ironic. He felt that a being greater than the shogun had just bestowed on him an appointment much higher than that of official tutor. The word of the gods had been vouchsafed to him.
"He took it well," thought Tadakatsu,
gazing rather pointedly at Musashi. Aloud he said,
"Perhaps it is presumptuous of me, but I've been told you have artistic interests unusual in a samurai. I would like to show an example of your work to the shogun. Replying to the malicious gossip of ordinary people is unimportant. I think it would be more befitting a noble samurai to rise above the babble of the crowd and leave behind a wordless testimony to the purity of his heart. A work of art would be appropriate, don't you think?"
While Musashi was still pondering the meaning of this, Tadakatsu said,
"I hope I will see you again,"
and left the room. Musashi raised his head and sat up straight. It was a couple of minutes before he grasped the meaning of Tadakatsu's words. That is, there was no need to answer malicious gossip, but he had to give evidence of his character. If he could do this, His honor would be unsullied, and the men who had recommended him would suffer no loss of face. Musashi's eye fell on a 6-panel screen in one corner of the room. It was invitingly blank. Summoning a young samurai from the guardroom, he explained that Lord Sakai had asked him to draw a picture and requested materials with which to comply: brushes, ink of good quality, some aged cinnabar, and a bit of blue pigment. It occurred to Musashi what an odd fact it was that most children could draw, and sing for that matter, but that they forgot how to as they grew older. Perhaps the little bit of wisdom they acquired inhibited them. He himself was no exception. As a child, he had often drawn pictures, this having been one of his favorite ways of overcoming loneliness. But from the age of 13 or 14 until he was past 20, he gave up drawing almost entirely. In the course of his travels, he had often stopped over at temples or the houses of the wealthy, where he had the opportunity to see good paintings, murals, or scrolls hanging in alcoves, and this had given him a lively interest in art. The aristocratic simplicity and subtle profundity of Liang Kai's painting of chestnuts had made an especially deep impression. After seeing that work at Koetz's house, he had availed himself of every opportunity to view rare Chinese paintings of the Song Dynasty, the works of the 15th century Japanese Zen masters, and the paintings of contemporary masters of the Kano school, particularly Kano Sandaku and Kaiho Yusho. Naturally, he had his likes and dislikes. Liang Kai's bold, virile brushwork, as seen by a swordsman's eye, struck him as revealing the prodigious strength of a giant. Kaiho Yusho, possibly because he was of samurai origin, had in his old age achieved such a high degree of purity that Musashi considered him a worthy man to take as a model. He was also attracted by the light impromptu effects in the works of the hermit priest and aesthete Shokado Shoujo, whom he liked all the more because he was reputed to be a close friend of Takuan. Painting, which seemed far removed from the path he had chosen, was hardly an art for a person who rarely spent a full month in any one place. Yet he did paint from time to time. As in the case of other adults who have forgotten how to draw, his mind would work, but not his spirit. Intent upon drawing skillfully, he was unable to express himself naturally. Many had been the times he had become discouraged and quit. Then, sooner or later, some impulse invariably moved him to pick up the brush again, in secret. Being ashamed of his paintings, he never showed them to others, though he allowed people to inspect his sculpture. Until now, that is. To commemorate this fateful day, he resolved to paint a picture fit for the shogun or anyone else to see. He worked rapidly and without interruption until it was finished. Then he quietly put the brush in a jar of water and left, without a single backward glance at his work. In the courtyard, he did turn around for one last look at the imposing gate, one question filling his mind: did glory lie inside or outside the gate? Sakai Tadakatsu returned to the waiting room and sat for some time gazing at the still damp painting. The picture was of Musashi no Plain. In the middle, appearing very large, was the rising sun. This, symbolizing Musashi's confidence in his own integrity, was vermilion. The rest of the work was executed in ink to capture the feeling of autumn on the plain. Tadakatsu said to himself, "We've lost a tiger to the wilds." The Sound of Heaven.
"Back already?"
asked Gonosuke, blinking his eyes at the sight of Musashi in stiffly starched formal dress. Musashi went inside the house and sat down. Gonosuke knelt at the edge of the reed matting and bowed.
"Congratulations," he said warmly.
Will you have to go to work right away?
The appointment was cancelled, Musashi said with a laugh.
Cancelled? Are you joking?
No, and I consider it a good thing, too.
I don't understand. Do you know what went wrong?
I saw no reason to ask. I'm grateful to heaven for the way it turned out.
But it seems a pity.
Are even you of the opinion I can find glory only within the walls of Edo Castle? Gonosuke did not answer.
For a time, I had such an ambition. I dreamed of applying my understanding of the sword to the problem of providing peace and happiness for the people, making the way of the sword the way of government. I thought being an official would give me a chance to test my idea.
Somebody slandered you, is that it?
Perhaps, but don't give it another thought. And don't misunderstand me. My ideas, I've learned, particularly today, are little more than dreams.
That's not true. I've had the same idea. The way of the sword and the spirit of good government ought to be one and the same.
I'm glad we agree. But in fact, the truth of the scholar, alone in his study, does not always accord with what the world at large considers to be true.
Then you think the truth you and I are searching for is of no use in the real world?
No, it's not that, said Musashi impatiently. As long as this country exists, no matter how things change, the brave man's way of the spirit will never cease to be useful. If you give the matter some thought, you'll see that the way of government is not concerned with the art of war alone. A flawless political system must be based on a perfect blending of military and literary arts. To cause the world to live in peace is the ultimate way of the sword.
That's why I've come to the conclusion that my thoughts are only dreams, childish dreams at that. I must learn to be a humble servant of two gods, one of the sword, one of the pen. Before I attempt to govern the nation, I must learn what the nation has to teach. He concluded with a laugh, but abruptly stopped and asked Gonosuke if he had an ink box or a writing kit. When he finished writing, he folded up his letter and said to Gonosuke, "I'm sorry to trouble you, but I'd like to ask you to deliver this for me."
"To the Hojo residence?"
"Yes. I've written fully about my feelings. Give Takuan and Lord Ujikatsu my warmest greetings. Oh, there's one more thing. I've been keeping something of Iori's. Please give it to him." He pulled out the pouch Iori's father had left him and placed it beside the letter. With an anxious look on his face, Gonosuke moved forward on his knees and said,
"Why are you returning this to Iori now?"
"I'm going to the mountains."
"Mountains or city, wherever you go, Iori and I want to be with you as your disciples."
"I won't be away forever. While I am, I'd like you to take care of Iori, say for the next 2 or 3 years."
"What? Are you going into retirement?"
Musashi laughed, uncrossed his legs and leaned back on his arms. "I'm much too young for that. I'm not giving up my great hope. Everything's still ahead of me. Desire, illusion, everything. There's a song. I don't know who wrote it, but it goes like this. While yearning to gain the depths of the mountains, I'm drawn against my will to the places where people reside." Gonosuke lowered his head as he listened. Then he stood up and put the letter and pouch in his kimono.
"I'd better go now," he said quietly. "It's getting dark."
"All right. Please return the horse, and tell Lord Ujikatsu that since the clothes are soiled from travel, I'll keep them."
"Yes, of course."
"I don't think it would be discreet for me to go back to Lord Ujikatsu's house. The cancellation of the appointment must mean that the shogunate regards me as unreliable or suspicious. It might cause Lord Ujikatsu trouble to be associated any more closely with me. I didn't write that in the letter, so I want you to explain it to him. Tell him I hope he's not offended."
"I understand. I'll be back before morning."
The sun was rapidly setting. Gonosuke took the horse's bit and led the animal down the path. Since it had been lent to Musashi, the idea of riding it never crossed his mind. It was about 2 hours later when he reached Ushigome. The men were sitting around, wondering what had become of Musashi. Gonosuke joined them and gave the letter to Takuan. An official had already been there to inform them of unfavorable reports on Musashi's character and past activities. Of all the points against him, the most damaging was that he had an enemy who had sworn vengeance. According to the rumors, Musashi was in the wrong. After the official left, Shinzo had told his father and Takuan about Osugi's visit. "She even tried to sell her wares here," was the way he put it. What was left unexplained was why people accepted so unquestioningly what they were told. Not just ordinary people, women gossiping around the well or laborers drinking in cheap sake shops, but men who had the intelligence to sift fact from fabrication. The shogun's ministers had discussed the matter for many long hours, but even they had ended up giving credence to Osugi's calumnies. Takuan and the others half expected Musashi's letter to express his discontent, but in fact, it said little beyond giving his reason for going away. He began by saying that he had asked Gonosuke to tell them how he felt. Then came the song he had sung for Gonosuke. The short letter ended, "Indulging my chronic wanderlust, I am setting out on another aimless journey. On this occasion, I offer the following poem, which may amuse you. If the universe is indeed my garden, when I look at it, I stand at the exit of the house called the floating world." Though Ujikatsu and Shinzo were deeply touched by Musashi's consideration, Ujikatsu said, "He's too self-effacing. I'd like to see him once more before he goes away. Takuan, I doubt that he'd come if we sent for him, so let's go to him." He got to his feet, ready to leave immediately.
"Could you wait a moment, sir?" asked Gonosuke. "I'd like to go with you, but Musashi asked me to give something to Iori. Could you have him brought here?"
When Iori came in, he asked, "Did you want me?" His eyes went immediately to the pouch in Gonosuke's hand.
"Musashi said you were to take good care of this," said Gonosuke, "since it's the only keepsake you have from your father."
He then explained that the two of them would be together until Musashi's return. Iori couldn't hide his disappointment, but not wanting to appear weak, he nodded half-heartedly. In answer to Takuan's inquiries, Iori told all he knew about his parents. When there were no more questions, he said, "One thing I've never known is what became of my sister. My father didn't say much about her, and my mother died without telling me anything I can remember. I don't know where she lives, or whether she's alive or dead." Takuan placed the pouch on his knee and took out a crumpled piece of paper. As he read the cryptic message Iori's father had written, his eyebrows shot up in surprise. Staring hard at Iori, he said,
"This tells us something about your sister."
"I thought maybe it did, but I didn't understand it, and neither did the priest at the Tokuganji."
Skipping over the first part, Takuan read aloud,
"Since I had resolved to die of starvation before serving a second lord, my wife and I wandered around for many years, living in the humblest circumstances. One year, we had to abandon our daughter at a temple in the central provinces. We put one sound of heaven in her baby clothes and entrusted her future to the threshold of compassion. Then we went on to another province. Later, I acquired my thatched house in the fields of Shimosa. I thought back to that earlier time, but the place was far away and we had had no word, so I feared it might not be in the girl's interest to try to find her. I consequently left matters as they were. How cruel parents can be! I am reproved by the words of Minamoto no Sanetomo. Even the animals, which cannot speak their feelings, are not bereft of the tender, generous love of parents for their offspring. May my ancestors take pity on me for refusing to sully my honor as a samurai by taking a second lord. You are my son. No matter how much you crave success, do not eat dishonorable millet."
As he placed the paper back in the pouch, Takuan said,
"You'll be able to see your sister. I've known her since I was a young man. Musashi knows her too. Come with us, Iori."
He gave no hint as to why he said this, nor did he mention Otsu, or the sound of heaven, which he recognized to be her flute. They all left together and hurried to the cabin, arriving shortly after the first rays of the rising sun touched it. It stood empty. On the edge of the plain was one white cloud. Book 7. The Perfect Light. The Runaway Ox. The shadow of the plum branch cast on the white plaster wall by the pallid sun was beautiful in a restrained way, evocative of monochrome ink painting. It was early spring in Koyagyu, and quiet, the branches of the plum trees seemingly beckoning southward to the nightingales that would soon flock to the valley. Unlike the birds, the shugyosha who presented themselves at the castle gate knew no season. They came in a constant stream, seeking either to receive instruction from Sekishusai or to try their hand against him. The litany varied little.
"Please, just one bout! I beg you, let me see him.
I'm the only true disciple of so-and-so, who teaches at such-and-such a place."
For the past 10 years, the guards had been giving the same reply. Because of their master's advanced age, he was unable to receive anyone. Few swordsmen, or would-be swordsmen, would let it go at that. Some launched diatribes on the meaning of the true way, and how there should be no discrimination between young and old, rich and poor, beginner and expert. Others simply pleaded, while still others rashly tried to offer bribes. Many went away muttering angry imprecations. Had the truth been generally known, namely that Sekishusai had passed away late the previous year, matters might have been greatly simplified. But it had been decided that since Munenori couldn't get away from Edo until the 4th month, the death should be kept secret until the funeral service had been held. One of the handful of people outside the castle who knew the circumstances now sat in a guest room asking rather insistently to see Hyogo. It was Inshun, the elderly abbot of the Hozoin, who throughout Inye's dotage and after his death had upheld the temple's reputation as a martial arts center. Many even believed he had improved it. He had done everything possible to maintain the close ties between the temple and Koyagyu that had existed since the days of Inye and Sekishusai. He wanted to see Hyogo, he said, because he wanted to have a talk about the martial arts. Tsukekoro knew what he really wanted, to have a bout with the man whom his grandfather had privately regarded as a better swordsman than either himself or Munenori. Hyogo, of course, would have no part in such a match, since he thought it would benefit neither side and was therefore senseless. Tsukekoro assured Inshun that word had been sent.
"I'm sure Hyogo would come to greet you if he were feeling better." "So you mean to say he still has a cold?" "Yes. He can't seem to get rid of it." "I didn't know his health was so frail." "Oh, it isn't really, but he's been in Edo for some time, you know, and he can't quite get used to these cold mountain winters."
While the two men chatted, a servant boy was calling Otsu's name in the garden of the innermost encirclement. A shoji opened, and she emerged from one of the houses, trailing a wisp of incense smoke. She was still in mourning more than 100 days since Sekishusai's passing, and her face looked as white as a pear blossom.
"Where have you been? I've been looking everywhere," asked the boy.
"I've been in the Buddhist chapel."
Hyogo's asking for you.
When she entered Hyogo's room, he said,
Ah, Otsu, thank you for coming. I'd like you to greet a visitor for me.
Yes, of course.
He's been here quite a while. Sekiro went to keep him company, but listening to him go on and on about the art of war must have Sekiro pretty exhausted by now.
The abbot of the Hozoing?
Hmm.
Otsu smiled faintly, bowed, and left the room. Meanwhile, Inshun was not too subtly feeling Sekiro out regarding Hyogo's past and character.
I'm told that when Kato Kiyomasa offered him a position, Sekishusai refused to consent unless Kiyomasa agreed to an unusual condition.
Really? I don't recall ever hearing of any such thing.
According to Inye, Sekishusai told Kiyomasa that since Hyogo was extremely quick-tempered, his lordship would have to promise in advance that if Hyogo committed any capital offenses, he would pardon the first three. Sekishusai was never known to condone impetuosity. He must have had rather a special feeling about Hyogo.
This came as such a surprise that Sekiro was still at a loss for words when Otsu entered. She smiled at the abbot and said,
How good to see you again. Unfortunately, Hyogo is tied up preparing a report which must be sent to Edo immediately, but he asked me to convey his apologies at not being able to see you this time.
She busied herself serving tea and cakes to Inshun and the two young priests attending him. The abbot looked disappointed, though he politely ignored the discrepancy between Sekiro's excuse and Otsu's.
I'm sorry to hear that. I had some important information for him.
I'll be happy to pass it on, said Sekiro, and you can rest assured Hyogo's ears alone will hear it.
Oh, I'm sure of that, said the old priest. I just wanted to warn Hyogo in person.
Inshun then repeated a rumor he'd heard about some samurai from Ueno Castle in Iga Province. The dividing line between Koyagyu and the castle lay in a sparsely inhabited area about 2 miles to the east, and ever since Ieyasu had confiscated it from the Christian daimyo Tsutsui Sadatsugu and reassigned it to Todo Takatora, many changes had been taking place. Takatora had, since taking up residence the previous year, repaired the castle, revised the tax system, improved the irrigation facilities, and carried out other measures to consolidate his holdings. All this was common knowledge. What Inshun had got wind of was that Takatora was in the process of trying to expand his lands by pushing back the boundary line. According to the reports, Takatora had dispatched a number of samurai to Tsukigase, where they were building houses, cutting down plum trees, waylaying travelers, and openly trespassing on Lord Yagyu's property.
It could be, observed Inshun. Lord Takatora is taking advantage of your being in mourning. You may think I'm an alarmist, but it looks as though he's planning to push the boundary back in this direction and put up a new fence. If he is, it'd be a lot easier to attend to things now than after he's finished. If you sit back and do nothing, you'll regret it later, I'm afraid.
Speaking as one of the senior retainers, Sekiro thanked Inshun for the information.
I'll have the situation investigated and lodge a complaint if one is warranted.
Expressing thanks on behalf of Hyogo, Sekiro bowed as the abbot took his leave. When Sekiro went to inform Hyogo of the rumors, Hyogo just laughed.
Let it be, he said. When my uncle gets back, he can look into it.
Sekiro, who knew the importance of guarding every foot of land, wasn't quite satisfied with Hyogo's attitude. He conferred with the other ranking samurai, and together they agreed that, though discretion was called for, something should be done. Todo Takatora was one of the most powerful daimyo in the country. The following morning, as Sekiro was leaving the dojo above the Shinkage-do after sword practice, he ran into a boy of 13 or 14. The lad bowed to Sekiro, who said jovially,
"Hello there, Ushinosuke. Peeking into the dojo again? Did you bring me a present? Let's see. Wild potatoes?"
He was only half-teasing, since Ushinosuke's potatoes were always better than anyone else's. The boy lived with his mother in the isolated mountain village of Araki, and often came to the castle to sell charcoal, boar meat, and other things.
"No potatoes today, but I brought this for Otsu."
He held up a package wrapped in straw.
"What's that now, rhubarb?"
"No, it's alive. In Tsukigase, I sometimes hear nightingales singing. I caught one."
"Hmm, you always come by way of Tsukigase, don't you?"
"That's right. That's the only road."
"Let me ask you a question. Have you seen a lot of samurai in that area lately?"
"Some."
"What are they doing there?"
"Building cabins."
"Have you seen them putting up fences, anything like that?"
"No."
"Have they been cutting down plum trees?"
"Well, besides the cabins, they've been fixing bridges, so they've been cutting down all kinds of trees. For firewood, too."
"Are they stopping people on the road?"
"I don't think so. I haven't seen them do that."
Skikuro cocked his head.
"I've heard those samurai are from Lord Todo's fief, but I don't know what they're doing in Tsukigase. What do people in your village say?"
"They say they're ronin chased out of Nara and Uji. They didn't have any place to live, so they came to the mountains."
Despite what Inshin had said, Skikuro thought this a not unreasonable explanation. Ookubo Nagayasu, the magistrate of Nara, had not relaxed his efforts to keep his jurisdiction free of indigent ronin.
"Where's Otsu?"
asked Ushinosuke.
"I want to give her her present."
He always looked forward to seeing her, but not just because she gave him sweets and said nice things to him. There was something about her beauty that was mysterious, otherworldly. At times, he couldn't decide whether she was human or a goddess.
"She's in the castle, I imagine," said Skikuro.
Then, looking toward the garden, he said,
"Oh, you seem to be in luck. Isn't that her over there?"
"Otsu!"
Ushinosuke called loudly. She turned and smiled. Running breathlessly to her side, he held up his package.
"Look, I caught a nightingale. It's for you."
"A nightingale?" Frowning, she kept her hands close to her sides. Ushinosuke looked disappointed.
"It has a beautiful voice," he said. "Wouldn't you like to hear it?"
"I would, but only if it's free to fly wherever it wants to. Then it'll sing pretty songs for us."
"I guess you're right," he said with a little pout. "Do you want me to turn her loose?"
"I appreciate your wanting to give me a present, but yes, that'll make me happier than keeping it." Silently, Ushinosuke split open the straw package, and like an arrow, the bird flew away over the castle wall.
"There, you see how glad it is to be free?" said Otsu. "They call nightingales harbingers of spring, don't they? Maybe somebody will bring you good news."
A messenger bringing news as welcome as the coming of spring? It's true there's something I'm longing to hear. As Otsu started walking toward the woods and bamboo grove in back of the castle, Ushinosuke fell in at her side.
"Where are you going?"
he asked. "I've been inside a lot lately. I thought I'd go up the hill and look at the plum blossoms for a change."
"Plum blossoms? Those up there aren't much to look at. You should go to Tsukigase."
"That might be nice. Is it far?"
"A couple of miles or so. Why don't you go? I brought firewood today, so I have the ox with me."
Having scarcely been outside the castle all winter, Otsu made up her mind quickly. Without telling anyone where she was going, the two of them strolled down to the back gate, which was used by tradesmen and others having business at the castle. It was guarded by a samurai armed with a lance. He nodded and smiled at Otsu. Ushinosuke, too, was a familiar figure, and he let them out the gate without checking the boy's written permission to be in the castle grounds. People in the fields and on the road spoke a friendly greeting to Otsu, whether they knew her or not. When the dwellings became sparser, she looked back at the white castle nestled on the skirt of the mountain and said, "Can I get back home while it's still light?"
"Sure, but I'll come back with you anyway."
"Araki village is beyond Tsukigase, isn't it?"
"Doesn't matter."
Chatting about various things, they passed a salt shop where a man was bartering some boar meat for a sack of salt. He finished his transaction, came out, and walked along the road behind them. With the snow melting, the road grew worse and worse. There were few travelers.
"Ushinosuke," said Otsu, "you always come to Koyagyu, don't you?"
"Yes."
"Isn't Ueno Castle closer to Araki Village?"
"It is, but there's no great swordsman like Lord Yagyu at Ueno Castle."
"Do you like swords?"
"Uh-huh."
He stopped the ox, let go of the rope, and ran down to the edge of the stream. There was a bridge from which a log had fallen. He put it back in place and waited for the man behind them to cross first. The man looked like a ronin. As he walked by Otsu, he eyed her brazenly, then glanced back several times from the bridge and from the other side, before disappearing into a fold of the mountain.
"Who do you suppose that is?" asked Otsu nervously.
"Did he frighten you?"
"No, but..."
"There are lots of ronin in the mountains around here."
"Are there?"
she said uneasily.
Over his shoulder, Ushinosuke said, "Otsu, I wonder if you'd help me. Do you think you could ask Master Kimura to hire me? I mean, you know, I could sweep the garden, draw water, do things like that."
It was only recently that the boy had received special permission from Tsukekuro to enter the dojo and watch the men at practice, but already he had only one ambition. His ancestors bore the surname Kikumura. The head of the family for several generations had used the given name Mataemon. Ushinosuke had decided that when he became a samurai, he would take the name Mataemon, but none of the Kikumuras had done anything of particular note. He'd change his surname to that of his village, and if his dream came true, become famous far and wide as Araki Mataemon. As Otsu listened, she thought of Jotaro and was seized by a sense of loneliness. She was 25 now. He must be 19 or 20. Looking around at the plum blossoms, not yet in full bloom, she couldn't help but feel that spring had already passed for her.
"Let's go back, Ushinosuke," she said suddenly.
He gave her a questioning look, but obediently turned the ox around.
"Stop!"
shouted a loud male voice.
Two other ronin had joined the one from the salt shop. All three came and stood around the ox with their arms folded. "What do you want?" asked Ushinosuke.
The men kept their eyes fixed on Otsu.
"I see what you mean," said one. "She's a beauty, isn't she?"
"I've seen her somewhere before," said the third man. "In Kyoto, I think."
"She must be from Kyoto, certainly not from any of the villages around here."
"I don't remember whether it was at the Yoshioka school or somewhere else, but I know I've seen her."
"Were you at the Yoshioka school?"
"For 3 years after Sekigahara."
"If you've got any business with us, say what it is,"
Ushinosuke said angrily.
"We want to get back before dark."
One of the ronin glared at him, as if noticing him for the first time.
"You're from Araki, aren't you? One of the charcoal makers?"
"Yes. So what?"
"We don't need you. Run along home."
"That's just what I'm going to do."
He pulled the rope taut, and one man gave him a look that would have had most boys trembling with fright.
"Get out of the way," said Ushinosuke.
"This lady's going with us."
"Going where?"
"What difference does it make to you? Give me that rope."
"No."
"Say, he doesn't think I mean it."
The other two men, squaring their shoulders and glowering, moved in on Ushinosuke. One presented a fist as hard as a pine knot in front of his chin. Otsu clutched the ox's back. The tilt of Ushinosuke's eyebrows said very clearly something was going to happen.
"Oh no, stop!"
she cried, hoping to keep the boy from doing anything rash. But the plaintive note in her voice just spurred him to action. He lashed out swiftly with one leg, caught the man in front of him, sending him staggering backward. No sooner was Ushinosuke's foot in contact with the ground again than he rammed his head into the gut of the man on his left. Simultaneously, he got a grip on the man's sword and pulled it from its scabbard. Then he began swinging. He moved with lightning quickness. He whirled and seemed to be attacking in every direction at the same time, all three opponents at once with equal force. Whether he was acting brilliantly out of instinct or out of childish recklessness, his unorthodox tactics took the Ronin by surprise. The reverse swing of the sword drove forcefully into the chest of one man. Otsu cried out, but her voice was drowned by the scream of the wounded man. He fell toward the ox, a geyser of blood spurting into the animal's face. Terrified, the ox let out an indescribable shriek. Just then, Ushinosuke's sword cut deeply into its rump. With another shriek, the ox set off at a near gallop. The other two Ronin rushed at Ushinosuke, who was leaping nimbly from rock to rock in the stream bed. "I didn't do anything wrong! It was you!" he shouted. Realizing he was out of their reach, the two Ronin started after the ox. Ushinosuke jumped back onto the road and took after them, shouting, "Running away? You running away?" One man stopped and half turned. "You little bastard! Leave him till later!" shouted the other man. The ox, blind with fear, left the valley road and ran up a low hill, traveled a short distance along the crest, and plunged down the other side. In a very short time, it covered a considerable distance, reaching a point not far from the Yagyu fief. Otsu, her eyes shut in resignation, managed to keep from being thrown by clinging to the pack saddle. She could hear the voices of the people they were passing, but was too stunned to utter a cry for help. Not that it would have done any good. None of the people commenting on the spectacle had the courage to stop the demented beast. When they were almost to Hanya Plain, a man came from a side road into the middle of the main road, which, though very narrow, was the Kasagi High Road. He had a letter case slung from his shoulder and appeared to be a servant of some sort. People were shouting, "Watch out! Get out of the way!" But he walked on, right in the path of the ox. Then there was a terrible cracking sound. "He's been gored! The idiot!" But it wasn't as the bystanders first thought. The sound they'd heard was not that of the ox striking the man, but of the man landing a stunning blow on the side of the animal's head. The ox lifted its heavy neck sideways, turned halfway around, and started back the other way. It hadn't gone 10 feet before it came to a dead halt, saliva streaming from its mouth, its whole body shaking. "Get down quick," the man said to Otsu. Onlookers crowded around excitedly, staring at the man's foot, which was firmly planted on the rope. Once she was safely on the ground, Otsu bowed to her rescuer, though she was still too dazed to know where she was or what she was doing. "Why should a gentle animal like this go mad?" asked the man, as he led the ox to the side of the road and tied it to a tree. Catching sight of the blood on the animal's legs, he said, "What's this now? Why, it's been cut with a sword." While he was examining the wound and muttering to himself, Kimura Sekiro pushed through the ring of people and sent them on their way. "Aren't you Abbot Inshun's attendant?" he asked, even before he'd had a chance to catch his breath.
"How fortunate to meet you here, sir. I have a letter for you from the abbot. If you don't mind, I'd like to ask you to read it immediately."
He took the letter from the case and handed it to Sekiro.
"For me?"
Sekiro asked with surprise. Having ascertained there was no mistake, he opened it and read,
"Regarding the samurai at Tsukigase, I have, since our conversation yesterday, verified that they are not Lord Todo's men. They are riffraff, ronin expelled from the cities, who have holed up there for the winter. I hasten to inform you of this unfortunate error on my part."
"Thank you," said Sekiro.
"This agrees with what I've learned from another source. Tell the abbot I am much relieved, and trust that he is too."
"Forgive me for delivering the letter in the middle of the road. I'll convey your message to the abbot. Goodbye."
Wait a minute. How long have you been at the Hozoin?
Not long.
What's your name?
I'm called Torazo.
I wonder, mumbled Skikuro, scrutinizing the man's face. Are you by any chance Hamada Toranosuke?
No.
I've never met Hamada, but there's a man at the castle who insists Hamada's now serving as Inshin's attendant.
Yes, sir.
Is it a case of mistaken identity? Torazo, red in the face, lowered his voice.
Actually, I am Hamada. I've come to the Hozoin for reasons of my own. To avoid further disgrace to my teacher and greater shame to myself, I'd like to keep my identity secret, if you don't mind.
Don't worry. I had no intention of prying into your affairs.
I'm sure you've heard about Tadaki. His abandoning his school and retiring to the mountains was due to a mistake of mine. I've given up my status. Doing menial tasks at the temple will be good discipline. I didn't give the priests my real name. It's all very embarrassing.
The outcome of Tadaki's fight with Kojiro is no secret. Kojiro told everyone he met between Edo and Buzen. I take it you've resolved to clear your teacher's name?
One of these days. I'll see you again, sir.
Torazo took his leave swiftly, as though unable to endure another moment. Hemp seed. Hyogo was growing concerned. After going to Otsu's room with a letter from Takuan in his hand, he'd searched for her all over the castle grounds, more and more urgently as the hours passed. The letter, dated the 10th month of the previous year, but inexplicably delayed, told of Musashi's pending appointment as an instructor to the shogun. Takuan had asked that Otsu come to the capital as soon as possible, since Musashi would soon need a house as well as someone to look after it. Hyogo couldn't wait to see her face light up. Not finding her, he finally went to question the guard at the gate and was told men were out looking for her. Hyogo took a deep breath, thinking how unlike Otsu it was to cause people to worry, how unlike her not to leave word. She rarely acted impulsively, even in the smallest matters. Before he began to imagine the worst, however, news came that they were back, Otsu with Skekuro and Ushinosuke with the men sent to Tsukigase. The boy, apologizing to everyone for no one knew what, was obviously in a hurry to be on his way.
"Where do you think you're going?"
asked one of the attendants.
"I've got to get back to Araki. My mother will worry if I don't."
"If you try to go back now," said Skikuro, "those ronin will get you, and it's not likely they'd let you go alive. You can stay here tonight and go home in the morning."
Ushinosuke mumbled something vaguely acquiescent and was told to go to a wood storehouse in the outer encirclement, where the apprentice samurai slept. Beckoning to Otsu, Hyogo took her aside and told her what Takuan had written. He wasn't surprised when she said, "I'll leave in the morning." A deep blush revealing her feelings. Hyogo then reminded her of Munenori's coming visit and suggested she return to Edo with him, though he knew quite well what her answer would be. She was in no mood to wait 2 more days, much less 2 more months. He made another attempt, saying that if she waited until after the funeral service, she could travel with him as far as Nagoya, since he'd been invited to become a vassal of Lord Tokugawa of Owari. When she again demurred, he told her how much the idea of her making the long journey alone displeased him. In every town and inn along the way, she would encounter inconveniences, if not actual danger. She smiled. "You seem to forget. I'm used to traveling. There's nothing for you to worry about." That evening, at a modest farewell party, everyone expressed his affection for Otsu, and the next morning, which was bright and clear, family and servants gathered at the front gate to see her off. Skekuro sent a man to fetch Ushinosuke, thinking that Otsu could ride his ox as far as Uji. When the man returned and reported the boy had gone home the night before after all,
Skekuro ordered a horse to be brought. Otsu, feeling she was of too low a status to be so favored, refused the offer, but Hyogo insisted. The horse, a dapple gray, was led by an apprentice samurai down the gentle slope to the outer gate. Hyogo went part way, then stopped. He couldn't deny it. At times he envied Musashi, as he would have envied any man whom Otsu loved. That her heart belonged to another did not diminish his affection for her. She'd been a delightful companion on the trip down from Edo, and in the subsequent weeks and months he had marveled at the devotion with which she had cared for his grandfather. Though deeper than ever, his love for her was selfless. Sekishusai had instructed him to deliver her to Musashi safely. Hyogo intended to do just that. It wasn't his nature to covet another man's good fortune, nor to think of depriving him of it. He could not think of any act as being apart from the way of the samurai. Carrying out his grandfather's wish would in itself have been an expression of his love. He was lost in reverie when Otsu turned and bowed her thanks to her well-wishers. As she set off, she brushed against some plum blossoms. Unconsciously watching the petals fall, Hyogo could almost smell the fragrance. He felt he was seeing her for the last time and took comfort in a silent prayer for her future life. He stood and stared as she disappeared from sight. "Sir?" Hyogo turned around and a smile came slowly to his face.
"Ushinosuke! Well, well. I hear you went home last night after I told you not to."
"Yes, sir. My mother."
He was still at an age when mention of separation from his mother brought him to the verge of tears.
"That's all right. It's good for a boy to take care of his mother. But how did you get by those ronin at Tsukigase?"
"Oh, that was easy."
"Was it now?"
The boy smiled.
"They weren't there. They heard Otsu was from the castle, so they were afraid of being attacked. I guess they must have gone to the other side of the mountain."
"Uh-huh. We don't have to worry about them anymore, do we? Have you had breakfast?"
"No,"
said Ushinosuke, slightly embarrassed.
"I got up early to dig some wild potatoes for Master Kimura. If you like them, I'll bring you some, too."
"Thank you."
"Do you know where Otsu is?"
"She just left for Edo."
"Edo?"
Hesitantly, he said,
"I wonder if she asked you or Master Kimura what I wanted her to."
"And what was that?"
"I've been hoping you'd let me become a samurai's attendant."
"You're still a little too young for that. Maybe when you're older."
"But I want to learn swordsmanship. Won't you teach me, please? I have to learn while my mother's still alive."
"Have you been studying under someone?"
"No, but I've practiced using my wooden sword on trees and animals."
"That's a good way to start. When you get a little older, you can come and join me in Nagoya. I'm going there to live soon."
"That's way off in Owari, isn't it? I can't go so far away, not while my mother's still alive."
Hyogo, not unmoved, said,
"Come with me."
Ushinosuke followed along silently.
"We'll go to the dojo. I'll see if you have the natural ability to become a swordsman."
"The dojo?"
Ushinosuke wondered if he was dreaming. Since early childhood, he'd regarded the ancient Yagyu dojo as symbolizing everything he aspired to in the world. Though Skekuro had said he could enter, he had not done so yet. But now, to be invited inside by a member of the family...
"Rinse your feet." "Yes, sir."
Ushinosuke went to a small pond near the entrance and very carefully washed his feet, taking care to remove the dirt from under his toenails. Once inside, he felt small and insignificant. The beams and rafters were old and massive, the floor polished to a sheen he could see his reflection in. Even Hyogo's voice when he said,
"Get a sword,"
sounded different. Ushinosuke selected a black oak sword from among the weapons hanging on one wall. Hyogo took one too, and with the point directed toward the floor, walked to the middle of the room.
"Are you ready?"
he asked coldly.
"Yes,"
said Ushinosuke, raising his weapon to chest level. Hyogo opened his stance slightly on the diagonal. Ushinosuke was puffed up like a hedgehog. His eyebrows were raised, his face was set in a fierce frown, and his blood raced. When Hyogo signaled with his eyes that he was about to attack, Ushinosuke grunted loudly. Feet pounding the floor, Hyogo advanced rapidly and struck laterally at Ushinosuke's waist.
"Not yet!"
shouted the boy. As though kicking the floor away from him, he leaped high in the air, clearing Hyogo's shoulder. Hyogo reached out with his left hand and lightly pushed the boy's feet upward. Ushinosuke did a somersault and landed behind Hyogo. He was up in a split second, running to retrieve his sword.
"That's enough,"
said Hyogo.
"No, once more!"
Grabbing his sword, Ushinosuke held it high over his head with both hands and flew like an eagle toward Hyogo. Hyogo's weapon, aimed straight at him, stopped him dead in his tracks. He saw the look in Hyogo's eyes, and his own filled with tears.
"This boy has spirit," thought Hyogo, but he pretended to be angry.
"You're fighting dirty,"
he shouted.
"You jumped over my shoulder."
Ushinosuke did not know what to say to that.
"You don't understand your status, taking liberties with your betters. Sit down, right there."
The boy knelt and put his hands out in front of him to bow in apology. As he came toward him, Hyogo dropped the wooden sword and drew his own weapon.
"I'll kill you now. Don't bother to scream."
"Kill me?"
"Stick out your neck. For a samurai, nothing is more important than abiding by the rules of proper conduct. Even if you are only a farm boy, what you did is unforgivable."
"You're going to kill me just for doing something rude?"
"That's right."
After looking up at the samurai for a moment, Ushinosuke, resignation in his eyes, lifted his hands in the direction of his village and said,
"Mother, I'm going to become part of the soil here at the castle. I know how sad you'll feel. Forgive me for not being a good son."
Then he obediently extended his neck. Hyogo laughed and put his sword back in its scabbard. Patting Ushinosuke on the back, he said,
"You don't think I'd really kill a boy like you, do you?"
"You weren't serious?"
"No."
"You said proper conduct is important. Is it all right for samurai to play jokes like that?"
"It wasn't a joke. If you're going to train to become a samurai, I have to know what you're made of."
"I thought you meant it,"
said Ushinosuke, his breathing returning to normal.
"You told me you hadn't had lessons," said Hyogo. "But when I forced you to the edge of the room, you jumped over my shoulder. Not many students, even with 3 or 4 years of training, could execute that ploy. I never studied with anyone, though." "It's nothing to hide. You must have had a teacher, and a good one. Who was he?"
The boy thought for a moment, then said,
"Oh, I remember how I learned that."
"Who taught you?"
"It wasn't a human being."
"A goblin, maybe?"
"No, a hemp seed."
"What?"
"A hemp seed."
"How could you learn from a hemp seed?"
"Well, way up in the mountains, there are some of those fighters, you know, the ones who seem to disappear right in front of your eyes. I watched them train a couple of times."
"You mean the ninja, don't you? It must have been the Iga group you saw. But what does that have to do with a hemp seed?"
"Well, after hemp's planted in the spring, it doesn't take long before a little sprout comes up."
"Yes?"
"You jump over it. Every day you practice jumping back and forth. When it gets warmer, the sprout grows fast. Nothing else grows as fast, so you have to jump higher every day. If you don't practice every day, it's not long before the hemp is so high you can't jump over it."
"I see."
"I did it last year, and the year before that. From spring till fall."
Skikuro came into the dojo just then and said,
"Hyogo, here's another letter from Edo."
After Hyogo read it, he said, "Otsu couldn't have gone very far, could she?"
"Not more than 5 miles, probably. Has something come up?"
"Yes.